Accession number 11769.
Mr. Barry, Rewan, can you start off, please, by saying what a charioteer is and how you came to be one, please?
Well, a charioteer, as far as I'm concerned, is a person who, with company with another man, rides canine as a human torpedo, which is a machine somewhere in similar diameter to an ordinary torpedo with a superstructure for various purposes, which probably we can describe better on later on in a training. How I became purely fortuitous, I was in HMS Cormorant in Gibraltar when the war started, having gone out there in 1938, and France had fallen, and we none of us really expected to come back to England. We expected to carry on, to return to, say, America and carry on the fight from there. A notice, we were sitting on the upper deck with a friend of mine, and we're usual chatting as you do, watching the ship's cat gamboling on the upper deck. And he said, "Have you seen the notice on the notice board, Len?" I said, "No." So I went and had a look, and it was a notice calling for volunteers for special service. This was about the time of the Battle of Britain, before June, September 1940. However, having volunteered for this particular exercise, next thing was a medical examination, which I had and passed with flying colours, because I was a pretty fit person, what with being a member of the ship's water polo team, etc. Heard nothing more from my volunteering until I came home to England in October 1941. I then came back into the barracks, and was in the barracks one particular day when, what was the date concerned of that, June the 5th, 1942, there was a broadcast on the tannoy system in the barracks requesting me to report to the drill hall at the other side of the parade ground. Having done so that afternoon, I found myself in the company of about another 100 other odd people, men. We were then taken one by one into a side room and introduced to a commander who turned out to be Commander Sladen and a commander surgeon. The surgeon was obviously there to look at us from a physical and mental point of view. Commander Sladen was there to interview us for other purposes. His comments to me were, "Ah, Barry, believe you volunteer for special service." "Did I, sir?" "Yes, in Cormorant." "Sure, good Lord, I'd forgotten all about that, such a long while ago."
"Had you really forgotten?"
"Yeah." So he said, "Well, now we're going to take you up on that volunteering." He then asked me various questions about my physical fitness, etc. Could I swim? I said, "Well, yes, I was a member of the ship's polo team, water polo team in Gibraltar. Did a lot of boat pulling and all this sort of thing, boat sailing, swimming, obviously." He said, "Right, well, you sound as though you look fit, and you sound as though you're the type of person we're looking for. Report to HMS Dolphin this afternoon," which I duly did. Found myself in company of about another 12 other ratings from various ships in the locality. None of us knew what it was about. Next morning we were asked to report to the submarine escape chamber. The submarine escape chambers, in those days, was about 40 feet high and about 30 feet in sorry, 40 feet high, yes, and about 30 feet in diameter, and was used to carrying out simulated escapes from submarines which were stranded on the bottom. We went into the room adjoining this edifice, what you'd call it. And we were introduced to two submarine coxswains. Now, a submarine coxswain is a chief PO who is usually in charge of, as the name implies, steering a submarine in battle conditions. And also the name applies to a chief PO on small ships such as destroyers and the like. But in this case, they were involved in teaching escape methods with the Davis escape apparatus.
Had you by this time had second thoughts about having volunteered for special service?
I could hardly have second thoughts when I didn't know what we were doing. Not at this stage. Having been introduced to this escape apparatus and carried out escape procedure, we were still none the wiser, although we were beginning to conjecture. And it wasn't until Sladen got us all together one day and took us down alongside the jetty, where there was a small floating dock anchored. And in this floating dock, there was a... Across the end of this floating dock, there stretched a large piece of canvas. We all went behind this canvas and found lurking therein what we got. Yes, there it was, a large, round, what I can only describe as a log, machined log of wood, about 20 inches in diameter and about 20 feet long. In fact, it was virtually torpedoed to look at. It seemed to be equipped with some form of mechanism at the front end for steering and diving, with a tank in the middle, which we were to learn was for raising and lowering in a hurry by taking on water by what was known in submarine parlance as flooding, to go down and blowing out of the water with compressed air to rise to the surface. Commander Sladen then gave us a short lecture on what it was about, then questioned us, "Do you wish to carry on with this particular exercise?" Although in naval terms you never volunteer for anything if you can possibly help it, but once you have volunteered you don't back off.
So he got no response?
So in actual fact he didn't get any response at all. Nobody backed off, in other words. Question.
In the training procedure that you had, what was it discovered about your own particular physical capacities for doing this kind of work?
Well, I think as far as I was concerned, as was proved by the various tests that we had, my metabolism was well above average, and withstanding oxygen poisoning and such things as that, which of course is one of the hazards of diving using oxygen, that if you went below a certain depth you passed out with poisoning. But my metabolism seemed to be an excellent from that point of view, because I never did pass out.
What do you remember about the other individuals on the training course who didn't measure up to it?
Some did leave the party because of various physical incapabilities.
Can you give any examples?
Well, claustrophobia was one nightmare which became apparent. Most of them left voluntarily, but we had one particular case where he didn't admit to it, and it wasn't until he passed out with oxygen poisoning in the test tanks at C.B. Gorman's that his subconscious took over, and he was virtually a raving lunatic when we came to undress him. But eventually, of course, he came out and left the party after that.
Was there any sense of shame at having not been able to complete the course?
Good Lord, no. No shame on anybody's part. It was an unusual thing to ask anybody to do. No, I don't think there's any shame, and there'd be no criticism for any of the people that did leave the party or went for other duties. Some went for other duties in the party which didn't involve any diving. We discovered in the Davis escape tank some divers who had pierced eardrums due to diving. They, of course, were ruled out owing to lack of oxygen, because the oxygen being used was recirculated and would be just going straight out into the open water.
Which was the worst part of the training from your own personal point of view? Which part of it did you like least?
I suppose the initial introduction to going down in a helmet diving suit in the bottom of Portsmouth Harbour, where you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. And on commenting to the diving gunner who was in charge of this that I couldn't see, he said, "Well, now you know why a diver's hands are the most important asset he's got, because he can't see, he's got to feel everything." And this is why later on, with all our trainings and attacks, what have you, we never wore gloves.
What was your greatest fear in the training period?
Gosh,
I mean, from the point of view of the kind of accidents that might occur.
I think for my most awesome experience was the time we were carrying out a dummy attack on Titania, which was the base ship. At that time we had found that the best form of attack was to approach the ship beam side, or at the approximate depth of the ship, and go straight under it and then blow the ballast tank and come up. But in this case, I just, the machine missed the ship, but my body didn't. And the machine carried across underneath the ship with me stretched backwards over the ballast tank and unable to cut off the controls, so I had to be dragged right across the ship from one side to the other. Not a very pleasant experience, but luckily we made it.
Were there any actual casualties in the training period that you remember?
Yes, we lost one in the initial stages when we were first trying out at Horsey Lock. The routine was, when a man was down driving, you always had him on the end of a piece of rope, and every 5 minutes or so you jerk the rope, and you should always get a reply, a corresponding jerk. In this case, the attendant jerked the rope and he got no reply. All he got was he pulled the rope and there was no diver on the end of it. And we didn't find him till next day when they sent the helmet divers down to recover his body.
What do you think had happened?
I don't think nobody ever knew whether the rope came undone, or whether he undid the rope through some sort of bravado. We just don't know. But it certainly taught us a lesson. I think the next casualty we had was they brought the battleship HMS Howe into Loch Cairnborne when we were getting near the end of our training. And about six machines went out to carry out an attack on the Howe to prove that it could be done, which was done with great success, except by one machine where the man died, the number one, or the officer concerned, died. I've heard several reports, but the one report that I did hear was that he had failed to open the escape valve on the bottom of his oxygen bag. He'd been at depth and had come up in a hurry, and of course in coming up in a hurry the oxygen expands in the bag, and it has a direct effect on the lungs. But that was one theory, but since the war I've heard different theories. I don't really know what happened. Fact is, he died, that was it.
About what proportion of those on the course failed to get through?
From the whittling down process of somewhere about 20 ratings and 20 officers of the initial party, I think it was about 75% had got through the actual training exercises. One or two had gone to doing other duties within the party, which didn't involve any diving, because of probably for medical grounds. But otherwise, the selection process had eliminated most of the failures from the beginning.
Was the team always an officer and a petty officer?
The team initially was an officer and a rating of some description. there was all sorts. Able seamen, stokers, leading seamen, petty officer seamen, you name it. The rank of the person concerned didn't come into the picture. It was the ability to carry out the job that mattered.
What rank did you have, though, when you started?
Initially starting, I was a leading hand, and I was made petty officer just afterwards, under the normal course of promotion being a regular serving man. So I wasn't subject to the rapid promotions of naval service at that time.
Now, you, in the course of what you said, in the training process, you mentioned Portsmouth, Horsey and Scotland. Can you, in the interest of clarity, tell me whereabouts the training took place and in sequence, if possible?
We had, in sequence, we started off with the helmet diving in Portsmouth Harbour and Spithead. We were then introduced to oxygen breathing in Horsey Lock.
Where's that?
In the top end of Portsmouth Harbour. It's not Lock, Horsey Lake. It is a long lake which is used for the trials of torpedoes.
H-O-R-S-E-A?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's still in existence because I've been there and had a look at it. From there, after we were introduced to the wooden machine, the main party went to Scotland and joined HMS Titania in Loch Erisort, I think it was at that time. Some of us, about six in all, stayed behind to receive what we termed the real one when it turned up. And this was the real chariot, which I will describe. It was a machine of about 21 inches in diameter and about 21 feet long, with a hydroplane and a rudder at the stern. Coming forward, you had a locker at the rear end for carrying cutting tools, any spare magnetic mines or anything like that you wanted to carry. Then you had the position of the number two, and then forward of between the two you had the ballast tank, which was a tank blown to bring the machine up rapidly, or when you gained your trim, you expelled the air and filled it with water. The machine then sank with, you hoped, a neutral buoyancy achieved. But it was a handy piece of equipment to get you up in a hurry. Forward of that was the number one, and in front of him was a shield to break down the water pressure, which wasn't great, as the top speed was of only about 3 knots. The controls consisted of a rudder, combined hydroplane and one control, such as you would find in an aeroplane, but a bit more robust. There was a control for pumping in water to the two ballast tanks fore and aft. There was another control to pump water from forward to aft to achieve a level stability. And there was also a control for speed control. There was a clock, a compass, and a depth gauge, with the minimum amount of numerals on any of them, because they were luminous, and we found at night that when diving, at looking at the dials, of a fully luminous dialed piece of clock or what have you, that you lost your night sight. So we reduced it down to the minimum amount of figures you could have on the actual dial. Forward of that shield, you had a explosive head, which is filled with 500 pounds of Topax at that time, which was a very highly explosive piece of plastic contained within it, but it was very dormant. In other words, you had to have a dynamite charge to set off the main charge. The dynamite was set off by an electric charge to the dynamite, and the whole being controlled by a clock with an eight-hour delay control from the outside. The head was attached to the body of the machine by a handle that you lifted, and which released a ratchet gear, and then the head became detached, which you proceeded to put under the target and hold in position with magnets and hope there weren't too many barnacles on the ship's bottom, otherwise you had a long job in scraping them all off.
How would that have been done?
Well, we all had divers' knives, which is a long knife, almost as big as a Roman gladiator's sword, carried by all divers, even helmet divers to this day, because it's a heavy thing, because it has to be heavy to cut wires and things when a diver's underneath the water.
What, if any, do you think were the faults in the equipment that you had?
Well, there were various faults which only became apparent later on, but when you think at the we started training in June, and the first attack was launched or set out to launch against the Tirpitz at the end of the year, an awful lot had been achieved, so that obviously there were weaknesses in everything. Well, we'd had, in my case, it attacking Tripoli when we'd launched from the submarine, the control gear had fouled the jumping wire on the submarine and we were unable to dive the machine properly. Batteries were always a problem, especially when they were a bit old, because the machine was powered by 60 volts of battery, which is quite heavy in itself. Should give you about eight hours of full speed, which is a range of about 10 miles, but it never seemed to work out to that.
Okay. What did you think of the quality or otherwise of the instruction that you were given?
The instruction and the care and instruction was first class. Nobody could have done any better than what was done. In fact, the two coxswains in charge of the actual diving gear were actually nursed us, and they took all our moans about leaks and what have you with that with a shrug, and never moaned at all. In fact, when I went out to Italy on a later exercise myself, I sorely missed them.
What names stick out in your memory amongst the instructors?
Commander Sladen, of course, was in charge of the party. He was the driving force, may one use the word, in personality and everything else, being an 6'2", an ex-submarine commander with a very good record. His, may I use the word, sidekick was Commander Fell, who was a complete and opposite character, and he was one that did most of the training, did all the nursing, if you like to use that term.
How do you mean a complete opposite character?
Well, I describe Sladen as a very strong personality and high of stature and what have you, and he was one of these people who he had the power of command with personification, and that was it. Sladen said it, you did it. Whereas Fell didn't quite measure up to him, but he had a different approach. Are you with me?
Yes.
Right.
How much did you know of the work that the Italians had done in Alexandria Harbour in 1941 against the battleships there?
We'd heard rumours in the Navy. In fact, I was in Gibraltar when they'd launched one of their first attacks at our ships in the harbour, which turned out to be abortive. They did get into the harbour, and there was this head exploded at 8 o'clock one morning, and we wondered what the hell it was. We'd heard rumours. I don't know whether any of the officers knew. Obviously Sladen and Fell knew what it was all about. But quite obviously any service in those days worked on a need-to-know basis. And that's all I could say on that score.
How keen were you personally to get into operations?
Well, I think, like everybody, once you start these sort of things, you want to get going. In fact, I think twice it happened when we're getting towards the end of the training, we've got an operation coming up. We all got very keyed up, and then it was suddenly cancelled, and I think the cancellation was worse psychologically than actually going.
Which operation were you prepared for first?
The end of 42, November 42, about 30 of us, officers and men, left England and went out to Malta on what is known as Operation Principle. I think much has been written about Operation Principle. I call it Operation Disaster. Various attacks were carried. When we got out to Malta, the three submarines from which we'd been exercising in Scotland were there in Malta Harbour. At the end, I think it was about the end of November, the three submarines set out. One went to Palermo, two went to Palermo, and one went elsewhere and never got there and was sunk with all hands. So that was 10 of our party went in one fell swoop. There was one was drowned, another one was lost, an attack on Palermo. I think it was an attack on Palermo. I was on the Thunderbolt, assisting in dressing the attackers in that case. We returned to Malta. The Thunderbolt returned to Malta, and Trooper was the other submarine. P-311 never returned. All we knew at that time, she hadn't come back on schedule. But we know history reveals, of course, whether she was sunk by a mine or what, we don't know, but all hands went down. It was then decided that the remainder of us was the Thunderbolt with four of us and two dressers carried out an attack on Tripoli Harbour against two ships anchored there, which were what the Germans would use for block ships for blocking the harbour when the 8th Army